The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Luke Turner is an artist based in London. He is one third of the artist trio LaBeouf, Ronco, and Turner, and he is the co-editor of the aesthetics and culture website Notes on Metamodernism. In 2011, he published The Metamodernist Manifesto, and this week he is a guest on the Zero Books podcast. It's June 20th, 2018. I am Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you enjoy listening to the Zero Books podcast, check out our Patreon page and consider joining or becoming a patron. We offer two podcasts a week, and by donating or supporting us through Patreon, you help us to continue to produce and even expand our digital content. Right now, we are at 365 patrons. When we reach 400, we'll hire a second podcast editor to help with production. The music you're listening to right now is an 8-bit cover of Simon and Garfunkel's The Boxer, but in just a moment, you'll be listening to Luke Turner and I discuss metamodernism.
Luke Turner is an artist based in London. He is one-third of an artist trio, LaBeouf, Ronco, and Turner, alongside Shia LaBeouf and Nasha Sade Ronco. Is that how I say that?
Finnish, it's actually a Runka, but I can't roll my R's very well.
Okay, so I'm not even going to attempt that. But his practice grew from his work on the web in the late 90s. He is a co-editor of the aesthetics and culture website Notes on Metamodernism, and in 2011, he published the Metamodernist Manifesto. Luke Turner, thank you for coming on to the Zero Books podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to getting to the bottom of what metamodernism is. I'm going to actually start by pointing out that I wrote a little script about metamodernism a while back for Wisecrack about Shia LaBeouf. But that's really was the first time I had come across metamodernism was through looking at Shia LaBeouf's work as an artist. But metamodernism predates his involvement. How did you come to write the Metamodernist Manifesto
our collaborative practice, because it's interesting, different. To what degree this kind of pops, or when this pops on people's radar, because your video, that video introduced metamodernism to a lot of people, but also that's through our art practice, which all the works in that video are our trio, and the thing that introduced Shia to me was through the manifesto, and that was about 4 years ago, but I actually wrote it in 2010, I think 2011. And I had been kind of thinking after I did my master's at the Royal College of Art. So, I mean, the first thing to say, I see myself as an artist rather than a theorist. It's art kind of comes before theory. I think it should always be that way around. But at the same time, a lot of artists have a kind of parallel theoretical aspect to their practice. So I was trying basically for my own purposes to get a handle on what is going on in the world, but also what I think, what is my position as an artist at a time when it felt important for everyone to have a position, that this type of art that is without position, which is apathetic to the world, which is disconnected and detached, that felt resolutely dead. So I was, the manifesto was kind of written as me kind of thinking aloud, and then I came across a paper written by Tim Vermeulen and Robin van den Akker, two Dutch cultural theorists, called Notes on Metamodernism. And a lot of their writing really chimed with what I had been kind of writing, and they coined the term metamodernism. So straight away I thought, this is a kind of catchy term. It's a kind of slightly ridiculous term as well at the same time, which I kind of enjoyed. Mm-hmm. And so I published the manifesto and just kind of put it out there, and didn't know what would kind of happen to it. And it started getting picked up by, I think, a lot of the first places that picked up was the literary world in the States and the poetry world there, who I think had there's still a kind of practice of poets writing manifestos, whereas I was writing it as a kind of visual artist, and it's kind of absurd to write a manifesto as a visual artist now, or it was at that time. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting how that then kind of spread and caught on, and I think it just resonated with people. And then a few years down the line, Shire read it, and it resonated with him, and he kind of reached out, and then a couple of days later turned up on my doorstep, and we started, having conversations, and our art practice was born. But the need, I think, was for a new language or a new vocabulary to articulate where we're at, because postmodernism doesn't quite hit the nail on the head. We've moved beyond this kind of postmodern irony and detachment and cynicism and endless kind of deconstruction, but we've not got rid of that. That's ingrained within. That's a kind of default setting for our generation. But there's a real yearning to once again embrace sincerity and engagement and optimism and construction or some kind of reconstruction. And so metamodernism describes a kind of movement maybe between those two or multiple poles, polarities, or it's a kind of simultaneity of position. So it's ironic detachment met with sincere engagement, and it's a kind of essentially a romantic reaction to the crises of our times, I would say.
Well, this is interesting to me. I've since 2008 become more and more interested in Marx, and who is I think of as an Enlightenment thinker. And I also think of him as extremely wedded to a certain kind of rationalism. So I'm sort of allergic to the romantic impulse. I mean, actually, as a person, like, I'm not at all allergic to that, I tend towards that.
Right.
But I try to fight it and struggle against it. So to hear that metamodernism is a essentially a romantic reaction maybe to the postmodern dilemma is kind of troubling on the one hand, but I would
agree with that. I think the fact that maybe that you're feeling torn between those kind of impulses is reflective of a metamodern mode that you and we are all essentially occupying. The idea of metamodernism isn't that this is a movement and we're proposing something. The idea of metamodernism is that this is a mode that has now become the prevailing mode of all culture, really, across the board, at least Western culture. So starting around the time of, some people like to put the date that this kind of started as some kind of definitive date that, as 9/11 would be a time where kind of irony was dead, that could no longer continue. But certainly by around 2008 and the crash and then things such as the Arab Spring happening and Occupy Wall Street, and there was this succession of movements and culture was reflective of that, and I think the thing that underpins metamodernism perhaps is hope. And Obama's famous kind of campaign slogan was simply hope. And so I think the fact that you're torn certainly doesn't negate the fact that there is a resurgence of some kind of romantic impulse, I would say.
I think that another way to put it is, rather than saying it's a romantic impulse, would be to say that it's a kind of unearned closure. It's unearned but necessary, that is involved in any creation of a work of art, but also involved in any political movement, or even you could go down to, like, it's involved in any way of life, any culture has to have these sutures or these moments of kind of unearned closure where even though you haven't reached the end of what you could criticize, or you haven't reached the ground of knowledge, say, you are now moved to act and to do so based on a feeling as much as based on a reasoned out position. The necessity for that you can't avoid doing that, is what I think metamodernism tries to take up as something that's understood and reasoned about and is held in mind, so that you remain, even as you're acting on these moments of unearned closure, which is another way of saying meaning, even as you're acting in ways that seem meaningful to you, you remain kind of radically open to revision, because you understand that this moment of meaning is somewhat unearned, but that doesn't paralyze you. You can still act.
Yeah. It's interesting thinking about closure and begin, because I would say metamodernism is a kind of spirit of openness and beginnings, perhaps, that came after as a reaction against a climate in which, you had Fukuyama proclaiming the end of history. Yeah. That kind of, literally came tumbling down in 9/11. It's this idea that Western liberal democracy or capitalism was like the end state of things, and that was proved. The world was thrown into kind of a chaos again, which illustrated that it absolutely was not. It was completely flawed, and then the financial crisis just kind of prove that to a whole generation, and so we have a whole generation now that is living with their parents longer, is kind of crippled by the kind of mistakes of the previous generations, and then what direction that then takes is entirely it has gone in many directions, and metamodernism as something to describe where we're at doesn't necessarily describe all what one might consider the good things, although that's obviously subjective. I think hope can be, what hope is to you and me might be different from what hope is to someone like Richard Spencer or Donald Trump, for example.
I want metamodernism to be a part of the left project, and I want to keep it away from people like Trump.
Yes, but that's the thing. There is no. What has been going on with pretty much all culture that is native to the internet is metamodern, in the sense that postmodernism perhaps embodied media that were kind of passive, and you could, it was a kind of, perhaps you could view the television as a modernist media, or the film screen, cinema as modernist. Then you would say the VHS tape is kind of essentially postmodernist. It kind of democratized culture in that way and made it accessible to everyone. But it was still kind of a passive medium. In the sense, or there were still kind of hierarchies of production, whereas the internet, social media, signals a much more democratic and a much more kind of two-way creation of of media, which is, you know, we are consumers as much as we are producers, all of us, and we all have our own channels now. And the language of the what exists and has been created and what spreads on those platforms is, I think, entirely metamodern. And it operates in this mode that has a relationship to irony and sincerity that is beyond what is described as postmodern. It is this at once sincere and ironic mode in which one doesn't negate the other. It's just something else. So where that leaves you, I mean, this mode that is not one thing or the other that came before, but it is an entirely separate or a new mode, but nonetheless is building on what has come before. But yeah, that can absolutely be deployed for positive social good, and it can be deployed for, you know, to use Pepe the Frog. It's a, you know, perfect example.
Pepe, are you hiding in the grass? Pepe, come here. Don't hop away. Pepe? Pepe? I have a frog and his name is Pepe. Around the garden he hops and hops. He's very green and he has no tail.
When I see these two words, I see postmodern and then I see metamodern. I feel as though metamodernism is friendlier to modernism than postmodernism is. That the modernist project of pursuing rationality, science, progress that postmodernism tried to overturn is being taken up again by the metamodernists. But the term meta, for me, that comes from like metafiction, the kind of self-aware approach to creating fiction. I'm a novelist as well as a publisher at Zero Books. So the metafictional move is one in which you're constantly reminding the reader that they're reading a story, that there are tropes and mechanisms and literary devices that are being deployed. You're kind of announcing that. You're never quite letting the reader fully enter into the fictional space. You're keeping it fictional. And if I think of metamodernism instead of metafiction, I would think of a modernist, rational, progressive project that was constantly examining its own apparatuses. It was constantly examining its own assumptions, its own technologies, without abandoning the production of a progressive movement or an optimistic line of flight, maybe from the present. And that postmodernism is one in which it basically wants to cast you into the abyss and say, not only, you know, can any particular story or set of assumptions or a political project be picked apart, there can be no political project that is substantial. And metamodernism says, no, we can have our cake and eat it too. We can pick things apart, but continue to move forward.
Yeah, I would largely agree with that. I think in terms of where we're directly coming from, we're closer to the postmodernist project. If there was a project, I mean, it's hard to, there isn't a metamodernist project. I'm not sure you could say there was a postmodernist project. There were definitely modernist projects or people who certainly, art movements that proclaimed them as modernists. Not very few art movements that called themselves postmodernist. I can only think of a handful, maybe Memphis as a kind of design movement, resolutely.
Right. So postmodernism came out of theory, really, more than it came out of an architecture, too. I guess there's some architectural movements that
were
overtly postmodernist. But it wasn't something that was taken up as a project. It was something that sort of happened to people. That happened to the arts as much as it was something that the artists tried to create.
Yes. And I think this is something that metamodernism is perhaps something that has happened to the arts that because of the complete lack, a complete dead end that that overtly postmodern artists led us to. I mean, you can't. I think if you went to an art college now and asked 100 students, you know, what artists they admired, I doubt any of them would say at this stage, you know, the kind of Jeff Koons or Richard Prince's or Damien Hirst's of this world. It's of no relevance to them or to the larger world. It's only relevant to a very small kind of blue chip art market.
You know, who do you admire as an artist today, whether it's contemporary or historical?
Miranda July, I would say her work kind of embodies a kind of metamodern spirit, but also in you know, musicians, people like Bill Callahan, he's a big kind of hero of mine. Mm-hmm. People, you know, anyone from Kanye to Future Islands and in cinema, like films, I would say, you know, something like Birdman, I love that. That was, you know, that felt like a kind of very much a kind of archetypal metamodern piece of cinema, because you could very well see a kind of postmodern version of that film, maybe made 20 years ago, but the ending would be completely different. It would be, it wouldn't have that kind of magical realism, like continue to the end. There would just be a one-liner at the end that would collapse the whole thing, perhaps. So that's not to say I'm not a big fan of postmodern cinema, but you know, it's art forms that we're just kind of one-liners that we're all kind of a bit tired of.
Understanding post-structuralism is actually pretty simple. First, you got to know about this thing called modernism. And modernism is kind of like your father when you were growing up, you know what I'm saying? It's like anything your father said to you, you automatically assumed was true. Your dad was infallible, right? It's like mainly because he was too young to see your father as another frail, godforsaken, limp dick motherfucker spewed out upon this planet to lead another empty life along with the rest of the lemmings on the subway. But, you know, your dad told you right from wrong, up from down, this was this from that. You know, he was making sense of the world for you. Your dad, what he was basically doing, he was establishing these grand narratives for you, you know, these big tales and shit, helping you make sense of the world. He was also establishing, you know, the essential binaries by which we come to understand the differences between the different phenomena, which is like another word for things, shit, in the world, you know what I'm saying? But post-structuralism pretty much came along. It was like, you know, fuck your father, fuck his narratives, you know, fuck his authority, and fuck his essential structures. For instance, you'll be like, this painting is truly transcendental. And post-structuralism is like, motherfucker, you can't step outside of history. The fuck you smoking on?
If I were to think of the artists I admire most, it would probably be early 20th century artists. It would be the constructivists and the suprematists, and I would like the impressionists and the dadaists and the surrealists. That's where I kind of stay. I mean, I like conceptual and contemporary art, but I can't defend it the way I can defend some of these earlier movements for some reason. I'm not sure if that makes me just sort of nostalgic.
Where do you stand on someone like Joseph Beuys?
Did he like do artworks with wolves and?
With wolves, yeah. I did a piece with a called "I Like America and America Likes Me," where he went to visited America for the first, I think, and only time, and his feet didn't touch the ground the whole time from the airport to the gallery. He was whisked in a Butner Gurney into an ambulance and driven to the gallery, and then he spent a week penned into the gallery with a live coyote, and then went out. these performance works that
I kind of align him with Fluxus.
There's so many blurring of lines in art, and it becomes difficult to say this artist or even this art movement is modernist or postmodernist or metamodern, because artists largely are working also on the fringes or on the avant-garde. And what we're kind of talking about when we talk about metamodernism and postmodernism, I would say, is when these things enter the become the kind of dominant cultural mode of our times. So there are things, you know, there are, you can see kind of glimpses of things that you might say were a kind of metamodern spirit within Dada, for example.
Today we're exploring the bizarre antics of movie star slash performance artist slash internet meme Shia LaBeouf.
Do it! Do it! Do it! Do it! Just do it! Do it! Do it! Do it!
Yeah, we've got, so we've been doing this practice for nearly five years, I think. So we've just got, I would say, the most kind of all-encompassing work. We've just made a film from a project we did 2 years ago in the summer of 2016, which is called Hashtag Take Me Anywhere, where we, which is a kind of very deliberately kind of, innocent or optimistic work, or it's kind of built on a kind of informed naivety. So we posted our GPS coordinates every day online and just literally with the hashtag Take Me Anywhere and invited anyone to come and pick us up with no rules, but they could take us anywhere. And we did that for a month. And
did that for a full month?
Yeah, and there was a map online showing us in real time where we were at any given moment, and you could track our progress. And we ended up covering over, I think, 10,000 miles right across North America through Canada, and we ended up in Alaska. But and we met dozens and dozens of people picked us up. I think it was about 70 people who we kept adding actually to this little Facebook group of all these people we'd met online. And then they became this kind of community of people who hadn't even met each other. They started meeting up with each other. And 2 years later, they're this really thriving community. So our works tend to kind of try and engage the networks, the online networks, and forge these kind of communities through these works. And that worked. You know, I was kind of a bit scared on that trip that, you know, anything could happen and are we going to survive?
Right.
You know, our kind of faith in people was kind of repaid spectacularly. Most well-known work we've done over the past year was a piece called "He Will Not Divide Us," which is a, you know, probably even more radically open than that piece. In that it originally, at least, involved putting a camera on a wall and streaming 24/7. And having it completely open for anyone to go, and we had the words on the wall above it saying "He will not divide us," and we are in our quite simple invitations for people to go and say those words or say whatever they wanted to say. And this was as a kind of a work that we wanted to be open to people of all, you know, no matter their political persuasions. Actually came about after meeting a lot of people from either political sides in the States, having traveled a lot through the middle of America, and I'd encountered a lot of groups there that felt kind of alienated and the art world didn't typically speak to them. So we wanted to make a work that was kind of resisting the divisive climate of our times, while making it open to them. And that statement was entirely open, but I think all potential interpretations of it retain some kind of hope and a resistance against division. But that piece has had a well documented, although not accurately documented, strangely enough, considering it was a camera that was on 24/7. But the life that's taken on has been kind of fascinating. But
yeah, you got trolled quite a bit during that.
Well, this is what the media would term it as. So what actually, I mean, there were factions of from 4chan and that you would term trolls, but it also got attacked by like literally physically attacked. The work was stolen by two members of the Traditionalist Worker Party, a neo-Nazi group. So it was literally the same people, the same individuals who were in Charlottesville with the tiki torches turned up in New York and started harassing people there. And we had Identity Europa and Nathan D'Amigo, the leader of there. They coined the far right slogan, "You will not replace us," and "Jews will not replace us," in response to our work in New York. Now we had a situation there, So we had a situation there where we were telling them. So we were doing it on the Museum of the Moving Image in Queens, and we were doing it there because obviously this work is incredibly politically charged, and we knew that it was going to attract some unsavory times. And so it's the museum's purpose. I mean, the number one purpose of a museum is to ensure that the kind of safety and well-being of the art and the public and the artists, right? That's their reason for being there. And incredibly, the museum there refused to put on any security, like as a deliberate act, and they put out a statement saying, the museum is not in a position to say what is and isn't hate speech and what is and is not allowed or obligated to do. So that, which is essentially, and this is in the face of neo-Nazis who were coming and engaging in extremely nasty abuse of people and harassment. And so their statement was, and their statement reads like a lawyer's statement, and it reads like Trump's, you know, find people on both sides statement. Anyway, it turned out that the museum's lawyer was also Donald Trump's lawyer. So,
oh, is that right?
Yes. So, and the museum, but actually that you know, the work settled down and settled into a rhythm, and you know, after a while those groups kind of got bored and went away. But the museum had already decided on the second day that they wanted to remove themselves from the situation. So you had this strange situation where a museum were kind of willing it to descend into some kind of chaos as a way of getting out of their contractual obligations, and they eventually abandoned it after 3 weeks. But
so you think that the museum's failure to provide adequate security and sort of back the project in an adequate way is what led to the work being misrepresented to a degree?
Oh yeah, they were. I mean, they were also actively misrepresenting it. So we were, from day one, we were also keen for them to make sure that this was framed as a political work, sure, but a nonpartisan work. That was the whole intent. And on the second day, there was a local councillor who basically said he was going to tell the museum to shut it down, which is a completely beyond his remit. But the museum then invited him to have a rally, a political rally, in front of our work. And they even used our camera footage. They pirated our footage for his own Facebook live stream. So they had kind of co-opted our artwork. The politics of it are kind of crazy. The head of security there was a big kind of Trump guy who didn't particularly understand what the intent of the work was, but he knew he wanted to shut it down, as they said. So the politics there got really messy incredibly quickly. And, part of our practice is kind of revealing these and uncovering the complexities and how information gets disseminated in the media, but also, it really held a mirror up to the gallery world. Also on the first day, the museum director I was having a conversation with him about London and how maybe London is, what I was saying, you know, America's a pretty racist place, right? And we were anticipating things happening and racists coming to the work. And I said, you know, the UK is pretty bad too, but living in London, it's quite a cosmopolitan place, so it's perhaps not quite so bad. And he said, yeah, I hear you just elected a terrorist as mayor. This was the day before Trump tried to introduce his Muslim ban, and I was like, you know, this is not a safe person to be running a museum. But the work has then gone on to have several iterations, and it's been we were getting serious threats of terrorist attacks, of mass shootings, and truck attacks in Albuquerque, where we took it next. So we had to close it there.
Clearly, metamodernism then can be used as a political tool. I mean, or has a political edge to it, despite the fact that you say it can be used by anyone. I think that the way your work exposes slices of life can be very threatening to right-wing forces or institutional forces.
It's confronting those same hypocrisies that that perhaps, you know, someone like Trump or Jordan Peterson would be attacking. In that, in New York, it wasn't necessarily the kind of far right factions that saw it closed. It was the hypocrisy of the kind of faux liberal art world, right? That would not, you know, they are the kind of liberal elites, you know, liberal coastal elites, as they kind of refer to. But then you saw also how much in cahoots they were with the media, with the New York art press, and how much of a sham it was, and how much there has been perhaps more fake news, about the He Will Not Divide Us project than any of our artwork, I would imagine, over the past 12 months. And it really is that. It is fake news. But it's been coming from people like the New York Times as much as it's been coming from, you know, the Daily Stormer or Breitbart.
Now, but you use, I mean, in the past, I mean, with like the Just Do It video, you use the fact that your work is going to be picked up, repurposed, and misrepresented as a part of the work often enough.
Yes. Yeah, that is true with that piece. And that became quite the result of that is that now when you search for Just Do It on Google, Nike doesn't come up in the top even 10 entries. It's our film, so we've undermined billions of dollars of advertising. you come across the kids in high school who you know see, or you see people taking pictures on Instagram of, oh, I saw someone walking down the street with the Shia LaBeouf slogan on his chest. You know, it's like rather nice. So and that's quite an interesting one, because the actual slogan "Just Do It," you know, had quite a sinister beginning anyway. I mean, it was the originated from the last words of a serial killer on death row. It was about to be taken to the electric chair, and I think he said something along the lines of "Let's do this," and then some advertising executives heard that and changed it to "Just Do It," and then it's became this kind of cause, and now it's become something which is this video, which is simultaneously absurd and ridiculous, but it's really bloody motivating, right? So the number of messages we get from people who are all over the world who say, you know, I have this the Just Do It video as my alarm clock each morning, gets me out of bed. Or people are like, well, this made me quit my job finally and go and do the thing they always want. That kind of amazes me that this thing has a genuine impact and is so motivating. I think that's a testament to Shia's performance in that. And it straddles this really strange line between irony and sincerity. And it's not, you know, 50% ironic and 50% sincere. It's 100% both at the same time.
Right. Yeah.
But the net result of that is, I think, some kind of movement forwards. You know, it's kind of hope you don't end up where you began with that. It's rolling things along somehow. So that's kind of how I would. Yeah, it really embodies that kind of metamodern spirit somehow. Yeah.